$40 to anyone who'd come in for half an hour, a poor man's usability test. We're like, all right, sit down. This is an invitation to Dropbox in your email. Go from here to sharing a file with this email address. 0 of the 5 people we tested succeeded. 0 of the 5 even came close. This was just stunning. We're like, oh my God, this is the worst product ever created. So we made a list of like 80 things in this Excel spreadsheet, then just sanded down all these rough edges in the experience and watched our activation rate climb. Virality almost always requires a product that is either free or freemium, i.e., free up to a certain point, after which the user has to pay to upgrade. Dropbox, for example, offers 2 gigabytes of free storage. We can't recall a single instance of a company that grew to a massive scale by leveraging the virality of a paid product. One of the most powerful distribution innovations is to combine both strategies. Facebook was able to do this by harnessing the organic virality of a social network, where users invite other users to join them, and leveraging existing networks centered around campuses by rolling out the product on a college-by-college basis. We'll discuss Facebook's rollout strategy in greater depth when we consider network effects. Growth factor number 3, high gross margins. One of the key growth factors that entrepreneurs often overlook is the power of high gross margins. Gross margins, which represent sales minus the cost of goods sold, are probably the best measure of long-term unit economics. The higher the gross margin, the more valuable each dollar of sales is to the company, because it means that for each dollar of sales, the company has more cash available to fund growth and expansion. Many high-tech businesses have high gross margins by default, which is why this factor is often overlooked. Software businesses have high gross margins because the cost of duplicating software is essentially zero. Software as a service, SaaS, businesses have a slightly higher cost of goods sold because they need to operate a service, but thanks to cloud providers like Amazon, this cost is becoming smaller all the time. In contrast, old economy businesses often have low gross margins. Growing wheat is a low-margin business, as is selling goods in a store or serving food in a restaurant. One of the most amazing things about Amazon's success is that it has been able to build a massive business based on retailing, which is generally a low-margin industry. And even Amazon now relies heavily on its high-margin SaaS business, Amazon Web Services, AWS. In 2016, AWS accounted for 150% of Amazon's operating income, which means that the retail business actually lost money. Most of the valuable companies we're focusing on in this book have gross margins of over 60, 70, or even 80%. In 2016, Google had a gross income of $54.6 billion on sales of $89.7 billion for a gross margin of 61%. Facebook's gross income was $23.9 billion on sales of $27.6 billion for a gross margin of 87%. In 2015, LinkedIn's gross margin was 86%. As we've already discussed, Amazon is the outlier, with a 2016 gross income of $47.7 billion on $136 billion in sales, for a gross margin of 35%. Yet even Amazon's gross margins are greater than those of a high-margin traditional company like General Electric, which in 2016 had a gross income of $32.2 billion on sales of $119.7 billion for a gross margin of 27%. High gross margins are a powerful growth factor because, as noted, not all revenue is created equal. The key insight here is that even though gross margins matter a great deal to the seller, they are irrelevant to the buyer. How often do you consider the gross margin involved when you make a purchase? Would you ever choose Burger King over McDonald's because Whoppers are lower margin than Big Macs? Typically, you focus solely on the cost to you and the perceived benefits of the purchase. This means that it's not necessarily any easier to sell a low-margin product than a high-margin product. If possible, then, a company should design a high-gross-margin business model. Second, high-gross-margin businesses are attractive to investors, who will often pay a premium for the cash-generating power of such a business. As the prominent investor Bill Gurley wrote in his 2011 blog post, "All Revenue Is Not Created Equal," investors love companies where, all things being equal, higher revenues create higher profit margins. Selling more copies of the same piece of software with zero incremental costs is a business that scales nicely. Appealing to investors makes it easier to raise larger amounts of money at higher valuations when the company is privately held. We'll delve into the details of why this is so important later on, and lowers the cost of capital when the company is publicly traded. This access to capital is a key factor in being able to finance lightning-fast growth. It's important to note the difference between potential gross margin and realized gross margin. Many blitzscalers such as Amazon or the Chinese hardware makers Huawei and Xiaomi deliberately price their products to maximize market share rather than gross margins. As Jeff Bezos is fond of saying, "Your margin is my opportunity." Xiaomi explicitly targets a net margin of 1 to 3%, a practice it credits Costco for inspiring. All other factors being equal, investors almost always place a much higher value on companies with higher potential gross margins than companies that have already maximized their realized gross margins. Finally, most of a company's operational challenges scale based on revenues or unit sales volume, not gross margin. If you have 1 million customers who generate $100 million per year in sales, the cost to serve those customers doesn't change whether your gross margin is 10% or 80%. You still need to hire enough people to respond to their support requests. But it's a lot easier to afford good customer support when you have $80 million in gross margin to spend rather than $10 million. Conversely, it's a lot easier to sell to and service 125,000 customers who generate $12.5 million per year in sales and $10 million in gross margin than it is to have to sell to and service 1 million customers who generate $100 million in sales to achieve that same $10 million in gross margins. That's 8 times as many customers and 8 times the revenues, which means 8 times as many salespeople, customer service representatives, accountants, and so on. Designing a high gross margin business model makes your chances of success greater and the rewards of success even greater. As we'll see in a later section, high gross margins have helped even non-tech businesses, such as the Spanish clothing retailer Zara, grow into global giants. Growth factor number 4, network effects. Market size, distribution, and gross margins are important factors in growing a company, but the final growth factor plays the key role in sustaining that growth long enough to build a massively valuable and lasting franchise. While the past 20 years have driven improvements in the first 3 growth factors, the rise in internet usage around the world has pushed network effects to levels never before seen in our economy. The increasing importance of network effects is one of the main reasons that technology has become a more dominant part of the economy. At the end of 1996, the 5 most valuable companies in the world were General Electric, Royal Dutch Shell, the Coca-Cola Company, NTT, Nippon Telegraph and Telephone, and ExxonMobil, traditional industrial and consumer companies that relied on massive economies of scale and decades of branding to drive their value. Just 21 years later, in the fourth quarter of 2017, the list looked very different. Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Facebook. That's a remarkable shift. Indeed, while Apple and Microsoft were already prominent companies at the end of 1996, Amazon was still a privately held startup. Larry Page and Sergey Brin were still a pair of graduate students at Stanford who were 2 years away from founding Google, and Mark Zuckerberg was still looking forward to his bar mitzvah. So what happened? The network age happened. That's what. Technology now connects all of us in ways that were unthinkable to our ancestors. Over 2 billion people now carry smartphones, many of them made by Apple or using Google's Android operating system, that keep them constantly connected to the global network of everything. At any time, those people can find almost any information in the world, Google, buy almost any product in the world, Amazon/Alibaba, or communicate with almost any other human in the world, Facebook/WhatsApp/Instagram/WeChat. In this highly connected world, More companies than ever are able to tap into network effects to generate outsized growth and profits. We'll use the simple layman's definition of network effects in this book. A product or service is subject to positive network effects when increased usage by any user increases the value of the product or service for other users. Economists refer to these effects as demand-side economies of scale, or more generally, positive externalities. The magic of network effects is that they generate a positive feedback loop that results in superlinear growth and value creation. This superlinear effect makes it very difficult for any node in the network to switch from an incumbent to an alternative, customer lock-in, since it is almost impossible for any new entrant to match the value of plugging into the existing network. Nodes in these networks are typically customers or users, as in the canonical example of the fax machine, or the more recent example of Facebook, but can also be data elements or other fundamental assets valuable in a business. The resulting phenomenon of increasing returns to scale often results in an ultimate equilibrium in which a single product or company dominates the market and collects the majority of its industry's profits. So it's no surprise that smart entrepreneurs strive to create, and smart investors want to invest in, these network effect startups. Several generations of startups have tapped these dynamics to build dominant positions, from eBay to Facebook to Airbnb. To accomplish these goals, it's critical to develop a rigorous understanding of how network effects work. My Greylock colleague Simon Rothman is one of the world's premier experts on network effects, from building eBay's $14 billion automotive marketplace. Simon warns, a lot of people try to bolt on network effects by doing things like adding a profile. Marketplaces have profiles, they reason, so if I add profiles, I'll be adding network effects. Yet the reality of building network effects is a bit more complicated. Rather than simply imitate specific features, the best blitzscalers study the different types of network effects and design them into their business models. 5 categories of network effects. On his Industrial Organization of Information Technology website, the NYU professor Arun Sundararajan classifies network effects into 5 broad categories. 1. Direct network effects. Increases in usage lead to direct increases in value. Examples: Facebook, messaging apps like WeChat and WhatsApp. 2. Indirect network effects. Increases in usage encourage consumption of complementary goods, which increases the value of the original product. Example: adoption of an operating system such as Microsoft Windows, iOS, or Android encourages third-party software developers to build applications, increasing the value of the platform. 3. Two-sided network effects. Increases in usage by one set of users increases the value to a different set of complementary users and vice versa. Example: marketplaces such as eBay, Uber, and Airbnb. 4. Local network effects. Increases in usage by a small subset of users increases the value for a connected user. Example: back in the days of metered calls, certain wireless carriers allowed subscribers to specify a limited number of favorites whose calls didn't count against the monthly allotment of call minutes. 5. Compatibility and standards. The use of one technology product encourages the use of compatible products. Example: within the Microsoft Office suite, Word's dominance meant that its document file format became the standard. This has allowed it to destroy competitors like WordPerfect and fend off open source solutions like OpenDocument. Any of these different network effects can have a major impact. Microsoft's ability to tap into multiple network effects with Windows and Office contributed greatly to its unprecedentedly durable franchise. Even today, Windows and Office remain dominant in the PC market. It's simply that other platforms like mobile have achieved similar or greater importance. Network effects both produce and require aggressive growth. A key element of leveraging network effects is the aggressive pursuit of network growth and adoption. Because the impact of network effects increases in a superlinear fashion, at lower levels of scale, network effects actually exert downward pressure on user adoption. Once all your friends are on Facebook, you have to be on Facebook too. But conversely, why would you join Facebook if none of your friends had joined yet? The same is true for the first user of marketplaces like eBay and Airbnb. With Network Effects businesses, you can't start small and hope to grow slowly. Until your product is widely adopted in a particular market, it offers little value to potential users. Economists would say that the business has to get past the tipping point where the demand curve intersects with the supply curve. Companies like Uber subsidize their customers in an attempt to manipulate the demand curve to reach that tipping point faster. The bet is that losing money in the short term may allow you to make money in the long term once you're past the tipping point. One challenge that this approach produces is the eventual need to eliminate the subsidies in order to make the unit economics work. When I was at PayPal, one of the things we did to encourage adoption was to proclaim that the service would always be free. This meant eating the transaction costs of accepting credit card payments. I wish I could say we had a grand plan. We had hoped that we could make up for the credit card transaction fee subsidy by making money off the float, the funds being kept in PayPal. Unfortunately, this came nowhere close to offsetting the fee subsidies, and the company was hemorrhaging money. So we switched PayPal from always free to ACH always free and started charging fees to accept credit card payments. Fortunately, we already had a loyal following and our customers accepted the change. When the business can't change the economics of the product, free services like Facebook can't lower their prices, it can instead sway the expectations of potential users. The value users place on the service when deciding whether or not to adopt it depends on both the current level adoption and their expectations for future adoption. If they think others are going to jump on board, the perceived value of the service increases and they become more likely to adopt it. This technique is reflected in one of the most influential business books of all time, Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm. Moore argues that technology companies often run into problems when they try to transition from a market of early adopters to the mainstream, the proverbial chasm. He recommends that companies focus on niche beachhead markets from which the company can expand outward using a bowling pin strategy in which these markets help to open up adjacent markets. This strategy is even more important for network effects businesses. A company can also reshape the demand curve by designing the product to be valuable to the individual user regardless of network adoption. At LinkedIn, for example, we discovered that public LinkedIn profiles had some value independent of the user's network since they served as an online professional identity. This gave people a reason to join LinkedIn even if their friends and colleagues hadn't done so yet. Connectivity enables network effects businesses. In addition to supporting network effects, the high connectivity of the world we live in today also makes it easier to reach the tipping point where network effects kick in and to sustain those network effects and the market dominance they produce. First, the internet has driven the cost of discovery for products and services lower than ever. Unlike in the past, when companies needed to offer goods in retail stores or broadcast advertising in order to be visible to customers, today, buyers can find whatever they're looking for on Amazon or other online marketplaces like Alibaba, in app stores, or when all else fails, by Googling. Because products and services that are already popular will almost always come up first in search results, companies with a competitive advantage can quickly grow to the point where the increasing returns of network effects produce a winner-take-most or winner-take-all market. This also explains why the growth factor of distribution is as or more important to company success as the product itself. Without distribution, it is difficult to reach the tipping point. After network effects take hold, the efficiencies enabled by the networked age make it easier to sustain the pace of rapid growth. In the past, rapid customer growth inevitably led to rapid organizational growth and to dramatic increases in the overhead required to coordinate a large number of employees and teams. Today's networks allow companies to sidestep these traditional growth limiters, such as when Apple used Foxconn to get around the potential limitation of its manufacturing infrastructure. More on this in the next section. The more you can remove those limiters, the more dominant a network's effects-driven business can grow. This is why companies like Google that have surpassed the $100 billion mark in annual revenues are still growing at over 20% per year. Finally, the remarkable profitability of these companies gives them the financial resources to expand into new fields and invest in the future. The S-curve of innovation argues that the rate of adoption of every innovation eventually slows as the market saturates. However, companies like Apple have mastered the strategy of investing in new products that let them hop onto additional S-curves. Apple hopped from music players to smartphones to tablets, and it is no doubt spending some of its vast profits chasing the next S-curve. The premium that the public markets grant these companies also helps them use mergers and acquisitions, M&A, to jump these curves, much as Facebook did with Instagram, WhatsApp, and Oculus, and Google did with DeepMind. Of course, network effects don't apply to every company or market, even if they are superficially similar, as many companies and their investors discovered to their chagrin during the dot-com bust, the Great Recession, and the funding slowdown of 2016. This is why the best entrepreneurs try to design innovative business models that leverage network effects. One of the reasons that Google is Google and Yahoo is now part of AOL, which in turn is owned by Verizon, is that Google focused on AdWords, a marketplace with strong network effects, while Yahoo tried to become a media company, a traditional model based on economies of scale. Much of Silicon Valley's historical success in building giant companies can be traced to its cultural emphasis on business model innovation, which results in the creation of network effects-driven businesses. The irony is that many people in Silicon Valley couldn't define a network effect or what caused it if asked. Yet simply because so many entrepreneurs are trying so many different business models, they can end up stumbling into powerful network effects. Craig Newmark simply started emailing his friends about local events in 1995. Almost 22 years later, network effects have kept Craigslist a dominant player in online classifieds, despite operating with a skeleton crew and making seemingly no changes to the website design during that entire period. This is where an emphasis on speed also plays an important role. Because Silicon Valley's entrepreneurs focus on designing business models that can get big fast, they are more likely to incorporate network effects. And because the fierce local competition forces startups to grow so aggressively, i.e., blitzscale, Silicon Valley startups are more likely to reach the tipping point of network effects before startups from less aggressive geographies. One of the motivations for this book is to help entrepreneurs from around the world emulate these successes by teaching them how to systematically design their businesses for blitzscaling. When you design your business model to leverage network effects, you can succeed anywhere. Designing to maximize growth, the two growth limiters. Building key growth factors into your innovative business model is only half the battle. It is fiendishly difficult to grow an amazing business, in part because it is fiendishly easy to run smack into obstacles that limit your growth. A key component of business model innovation is designing around these growth limiters. Growth limiter number one, lack of product market fit. Product market fit enables rapid growth, while the lack of it makes growth expensive and difficult. The concept of product market fit originates in Marc Andreessen's seminal blog post, The Only Thing That Matters. In his essay, Andreessen argues that the most important factor in successful startups is the combination of market and product. His definition couldn't be simpler. Product market fit means being in a good market with a product that can satisfy that market. Without product market fit, it's impossible to grow a startup into a successful business. As Andreessen notes, you see a surprising number of really well-run startups that have all aspects of operations completely buttoned down, HR policies in place, great sales model, thoroughly thought-through marketing plan, great interview processes, outstanding catered food, 30-inch monitors for all the programmers, top-tier VCs on the board, heading straight off a cliff due to not ever finding product market fit. Unfortunately, it's far easier to define product market fit than it is to establish it. When you start a new company, the key product market fit question you need to answer is whether you've discovered a non-obvious market opportunity where you have a unique advantage or approach, and one that competing players won't see until you've had a chance to build a healthy lead. It's usually difficult to find such an opportunity in a hot space. If an opportunity is obvious to everyone, the chances that you'll be the one who succeeds is exceedingly low. Most non-obvious opportunities arise from a change in the market that the incumbents aren't willing or able to adapt to. In many cases, this can be a disruptive technological innovation, but can also be a change in the law or financial regulations, the rise of a new group of customers, or any other major shift. For example, Charles Schwab was able to build his eponymous financial empire by leveraging the deregulation of brokerage commissions to launch a discount brokerage. Frequently, you won't be able to fully validate product market fit before you commit to building a company, but you should try. As authors and entrepreneurs, we're huge fans of Eric Ries and his lean startup methodology. It is an excellent process for systematically tackling risk. But the fact is that most startups don't follow that process. Instead, their chosen experiment is, do we succeed or run out of money? The best way for a small, resource-strapped team to assess potential strategies is to leverage what we dubbed network intelligence in our previous book, The Alliance. Even a small group of founders is likely to have a huge collective personal network of smart people with relevant knowledge or experience. Initiate a conversation, inviting them to challenge your idea and tell you what else you should consider. Of course, even the best network intelligence won't guarantee that you've actually found product market fit during this design phase. The only way to truly prove product market fit is to get the product into the hands of real users. But entrepreneurs can and should do their research and try to design their business model to maximize their chances of achieving product market fit as quickly as possible. Growth limiter number two, operational scalability. Designing a scalable economic model isn't enough if you can't scale up your operations to meet demand. Too often, entrepreneurs dismiss the challenges of operational scalability by saying, managing explosive growth is a high-class problem. High-class problems are still problems. It may feel better for your ego to be wrestling with the issues of growth rather than simply trying to avoid missing payroll, but both can still kill your company. Rather than dismiss these challenges, the wisest innovators design operational scalability into their models. A. Human limitations on operational scalability. A significant number of operational issues arise simply because of human limitations. As much as we might wish that we and our colleagues could work tirelessly and seamlessly, regardless of the scale of the organization, the fact is that growth causes us to trip over a wide array of issues. If you are leading a small founding team with four members, you have to worry about your direct relationship with the three other co-founders, plus their direct relationships with one another. Combinatorial mathematics tells us that this means you need to manage the relationship between six pairs of individuals, 4 times 3 divided by 2. Now imagine that you hire 2 employees for a total team size of 6. Now you need to manage the relationships between 15 pairs, 6 times 5, divided by 2. You increase the team size by 50%, but the number of relationships you need to manage went up by 150%. The math just gets more daunting from there, and that only considers the relationships of individual pairs of team members, not the relationships between any 3 members, any 4 members, and so on. One approach is to design a business model that requires as few human beings as possible. Some software companies employ business models that allow them to achieve massive success with minimal numbers of employees. The founders of WhatsApp, Jan Koum and Brian Acton, designed a clever business model that addressed some of the key growth factors. Their messaging service leveraged both classic network effects and the existing distribution network of telephone address books to grow faster, but also managed to skirt around issues of operational scalability. WhatsApp had a freemium business model. The service was free for a year, after which it cost $1 per year. This low-friction model essentially eliminated the need for people working in functions like sales, marketing, and customer service, allowing WhatsApp to grow to 500 million monthly active users by the time of its acquisition by Facebook, with a staff of just 43 employees, a ratio of over 10 million active users per employee. Another approach is to find ways to outsource work to contractors or suppliers. Airbnb's strategy for photographing its hosts' rooms offers an instructive example. Early on, Airbnb's founders discovered that one of the key factors that increased the chances of renting a room on Airbnb was the quality of the photographs of that room. Turns out that most of us aren't professional photographers, and our poorly composed, poorly shot cell phone pictures don't do a good job of conveying the awesomeness of our living spaces. So the founders took to the road, visiting hosts and taking photographs for them. Obviously, personally visiting every host was hardly a scalable solution, so the task was soon outsourced to freelance photographers. As Airbnb grew, the strategy shifted from the founders managing a short list of photographers to an employee managing a large group of photographers to an automated system managing a global network of photographers. Founder Brian Chesky describes this strategy succinctly. Do everything by hand until it's too painful, then automate it. Ultimately, even with clever business models and automation, nearly every massively successful company requires thousands or even tens of thousands of employees. Smart techniques can delay the reckoning, but not forever. Later on, we'll discuss some of the management innovations that allow companies to handle this kind of organizational growth and scale. B. Infrastructure limitations on operational scalability. The other main challenge of operational scalability comes from the strain of scaling up the non-human infrastructure of the business. It doesn't matter how much demand you generate if your infrastructure can't handle it. Infrastructure limitations can even be fatal to a company's ambitions. Consider the examples of social networks Friendster and Twitter. While many have forgotten it now, Friendster was the first pre-Facebook online social network to break through into the mainstream. Disclosure, I was an early investor in Friendster. Launched in March of 2003, Friendster rode viral growth to millions of users within months. Before the year was out, Friendster mania was such a cultural phenomenon that founder Jonathan Abrams appeared on the late-night television show Jimmy Kimmel Live. But Friendster's massive growth brought massive headaches, especially on the infrastructure side. Despite a talented technology team, Friendster servers couldn't handle the growth, and it became common for Friendster profiles to take up to 40 seconds to load. By the beginning of 2005, a faster new entrant, MySpace, was generating more than 10 times the number of page views as Friendster, which never recovered. MySpace, of course, ultimately lost the consumer social networking war to Facebook, which is a story we'll discuss in detail later in this book. Twitter came close to melting down in the same way, but managed to recover in time to build a massive business. When Twitter began its rise in the late 2000s, it became infamous for its fail whale, a whimsical error message that appeared whenever its servers couldn't handle the load. Unfortunately for Twitter, the fail whale made fairly regular appearances, especially when big news hit, such as the death of the recording artist Michael Jackson in 2009. To be fair, Twitter was hardly the only website that had these issues when the King of Pop passed away. Or the 2010 World Cup. Twitter invested serious resources into re-architecting both its systems and its engineering processes to be more efficient. Even with this strenuous effort, it took several years to tame the fail whale. It wasn't until after Twitter made it through the 2012 U.S. presidential election night without melting down that the company's then creative director, Doug Bowman, announced that the great blue whale had been put to death. One of the main reasons for the very large increase in the growth of valuable web companies that we've seen in recent years is Amazon's cloud offering, Amazon Web Services, AWS, which has helped many such businesses navigate around infrastructure limitations. Dropbox, for example, was able to scale up its storage infrastructure much more quickly and easily because it used AWS storage, eliminating the need to build and maintain its own arrays of hard disks. AWS reflects one of the ways that Amazon has made operational scalability a competitive advantage. Web services like AWS tap into what Harvard Business School professor Carlos Baldwin and former Harvard Business School professor Kim Clark refer to as the power of modularity. As Baldwin and Clark describe in their book, Design Rules, Volume 1, The Power of Modularity, this principle makes it possible for a company like Amazon and its customers to build complex products out of smaller, standardized subsystems. But the power of modularity goes beyond just software development and engineering. By building easy-to-integrate subsystems like payments and logistics, Amazon makes its entire business more flexible and rapidly adaptable. The equivalent to AWS on the hardware side is China. Hardware startups are able to manage infrastructure limitations and scale much more quickly by tapping into Chinese manufacturing capabilities, either directly or by working with companies like the custom manufacturing design firm PCH. The smart thermostat maker Nest, for example, had only 130 employees when it was acquired by Google for $3 billion, largely because it had outsourced all of its manufacturing to China. In contrast, Tesla Motors has seen its growth held back by infrastructure limitations. Due to the complexities of its manufacturing process, Tesla's production rates have lagged behind those of other automakers, the result being that its award-winning vehicles are almost always sold out, with back orders measured in months and even years. Demand generation is not a problem for Tesla. Meeting that demand is. Proven business model patterns. Whether by design or not, the business models of rapidly growing companies often follow proven patterns that tap into the growth factors and bypass growth limiters. These patterns will be described in more detail, but here it bears noting that these high-level patterns are principles rather than exact recipes. Simply adopting any of these particular patterns isn't enough to ensure an innovative business model, but understanding them does provide an entrepreneur with a set of good role models. It is also worth mentioning that not all patterns are created equal. Some common business models follow proven patterns, but nonetheless don't seem to produce $100 billion businesses or even $10 billion businesses. Take open source software, which has been wildly successful as a pattern for spreading software products like Linux. Open source, which means offering free, community-created software that users can modify, arose to prominence during the dot-com era and has been an integral part of the world's technology stack ever since. The story of open source software fits the pattern of business model innovation. Open source software serves a large market, has powerful distribution via open source software code repositories, benefits from the network effects of standards and compatibility, and neatly avoids many of the human limitations on operational scalability by tapping into a distributed community of volunteer contributors rather than building a large organization of employees. Yet, even the most successful open source business, Red Hat, has a market capitalization of only about $15 billion, and that's after being in business for two decades. The empirical evidence suggests that open source is a pattern that is valuable for engagement, but not for building massively profitable businesses. In order for a pattern to be proven, it must be able to demonstrate that multiple massively valuable businesses follow it. Based on that criterion, we've assembled the following list of proven patterns to help inspire your own business model innovation. Proven pattern number one, bits rather than atoms. Google and Facebook are largely software businesses that focus on electronic bits rather than material atoms. Bits-based businesses have a much easier time serving a global market, which in turn makes it easier to achieve a large market size. Bits are also far easier to move around than atoms, so bits-based businesses can more easily tap into distribution techniques like virality, and their ability to be highly networked provides more opportunities to leverage network effects. Bits-based businesses tend to be high gross margin businesses because they have fewer variable costs. Bits also make it easier to design around growth limiters. You can iterate more quickly on software products, many internet companies release new software daily, than on physical products, making it faster and cheaper to achieve product market fit. And bits-based businesses, as we saw with WhatsApp, can get away with far fewer employees than most of their atom-based counterparts. Back in 1990, the futurist George Gilder demonstrated his prescience when he wrote in his book Microcosm, "The central event of the 20th century is the overthrow of matter. In technology, economics, and the politics of nations, wealth in the form of physical resources is steadily declining in value and significance. The powers of mind are everywhere ascendant over the brute force of things." Just over 20 years later, in 2011, the venture capitalist and Netscape co-founder Marc Andreessen validated Gilder's thesis in his Wall Street Journal op-ed, "Why Software is Eating the World." Andreessen pointed out that the world's largest bookstore, Amazon, video provider, Netflix, recruiter, LinkedIn, and music companies, Apple, Spotify, Pandora, were software companies, and that even old economy stalwarts like Walmart and FedEx used software rather than things to drive their businesses. Despite, or perhaps because of, the growing dominance of bits, the power of software has also made it easier to scale up atom-based businesses as well. Amazon's retail business is heavily based in atoms. Just think of all those Amazon shipping boxes piled up in your recycling bin. Amazon originally outsourced its logistics to Ingram Book Company, but its heavy investment in inventory management systems and warehouses as it grew turned infrastructure limitations from a growth limiter to a growth factor. On the retail side, merchants pay Amazon to manage their inventories and logistics for them, while the massive computer systems that Amazon built to operate its retail business gave it the capabilities to launch its AWS business, which is a high-margin, bits-based business. Proven pattern number two, platforms. Platform economics predates the networked age and even the industrial age. Trade-oriented principalities like the Republic of Venice provided a welcoming ecosystem for merchants, complete with currency and the rule of law, as well as taxes to harvest the value of the platform. Technology platforms like Microsoft Windows demonstrated the power of being the chosen platform on which businesses were built back when the World Wide Web was still a glimmer in Tim Berners-Lee's eye. Sir Berners-Lee wrote his proposal for a global hypertext system in 1989. Yet, despite the proven value of platforms in the pre-internet era, the networked age has made them vastly more powerful and valuable. Rather than being limited, like the Republic of Venice, to a specific geography, today's software-based platforms can achieve global distribution almost immediately. And since transactions on today's platforms are conducted through application programming interfaces, APIs, rather than person-to-person negotiations, they proceed swiftly, seamlessly, and in incredible volumes, all with barely any human intervention. If a platform achieves scale and becomes the de facto standard for its industry, the network effects of compatibility and standards, combined with the ability to rapidly iterate and optimize the platform, create a significant and lasting competitive advantage that can be nearly unassailable. This dominance lets the market leader tax all the participants who want to use the platform, much as levies were imposed in the bygone Republic of Venice. For example, the iTunes Store takes a 30% share of the proceeds whenever a song, a movie, a book, or an app is sold on that platform. These platform revenues tend to have very high gross margins, which generate cash that can be plowed back into making the platform even better. Amazon's merchant platform, Facebook's social graph, and of course, Apple's iOS ecosystem are great examples of the power of platforms. Proven pattern number 3, free or freemium. Free has an incredible power that no other pricing does. The Duke behavioral economist, Dan Ariely, wrote about the power of free in his excellent book, Predictably Irrational, describing an experiment in which he offered research subjects the choice of a Lindt chocolate truffle for 15 cents or a Hershey's Kiss for a mere penny. Nearly three-fourths of the subjects chose the premium truffle rather than the humble kiss. But when Ariely changed the pricing so that the truffle cost 14 cents and the kiss was free, the same price differential, more than two-thirds of the subjects chose the inferior but free kisses. The incredible power of free makes it a valuable tool for distribution and virality. It also plays an important role in jump-starting network effects by helping a product achieve the critical mass of users that is required for those effects to kick in. At LinkedIn, we knew that our basic accounts had to be free if we wanted to get to the million users we theorized represented critical mass. Sometimes you can offer a product for free and still be profitable. In the advertising-driven business model, a large enough mass of free users can be valuable even if they never pay for your service. Facebook, for example, doesn't charge its users a dime, but it is able to generate large amounts of high gross margin revenue by selling targeted advertising. But sometimes a product doesn't lend itself to the advertising model, as is the case with many services used by students and educators. Without third-party revenue, the problem with offering your product to users for free is that you can't offset your lack of sales by making it up in volume. Here is where the innovation of freemium comes in. The venture capitalist Fred Wilson coined the term in a 2006 blog post based on a suggestion from Jared Lucan. But the business model itself predates the term, having its origin in the shareware model for selling software in the 1980s. The free product was a tool for discovery and gaining a critical mass of users, while the paid version of the software allowed the business to extract value from those users once its value was clear. Dropbox is one of the premier examples of a successful freemium business. By giving away 2 gigabytes of storage, Dropbox attracted a massive user base, a reasonable percentage of which decides to pay for the value and convenience of additional storage. Proven pattern number 4, marketplaces. Marketplaces represent one of the most successful business model patterns, with the dot-com era's Google and eBay and today's Alibaba and Airbnb standing out as examples of important, valuable companies that follow this pattern. One reason marketplaces are powerful is because they often tap into two-sided network effects. While it is difficult to create a successful marketplace from a cold start, the first marketplace that does manage to achieve liquidity, the ability for buyers and sellers to quickly and efficiently find a counterparty to conduct a transaction, becomes very attractive to both sides of the market. As buyers and sellers pour in, the marketplace becomes even more attractive to both parties, triggering a positive feedback loop that makes it very hard for new entrants to win any market share. Marketplaces also offer key advantages beyond the obvious network effects. By creating a liquid market where buyers and sellers both participate, the dynamic forces of supply and demand price their transactions better than any human judgment could. The more efficient the prices in a marketplace, the more value it creates, because that means more transactions that might create value actually occur. In contrast, in illiquid markets, sellers often misprice their products, resulting in fewer sales and less value creation than optimal. The best example of the benefits of efficient market pricing is probably Google's AdWords advertising marketplace. AdWords allows anyone to bid on targeted keywords in any quantity, so even the smallest businesses can tap into global distribution. Contrast this to the traditional advertising market, in which large clients spend millions of dollars paying advertising agencies to run expensive 30-second television ads during coveted programming like the Super Bowl broadcast. Google's system also measures advertising quality. Ads targeted at an audience to generate the most paid click-throughs are favored. The net effect is that consumers are shown the most effectively targeted ads without the overhead of a middleman like Don Draper and his three-martini lunch. Google also increases its own gross margin because, unlike commercials during a television broadcast, search-based ad space is virtually unlimited and costs Google next to nothing. Although marketplaces, even local ones, have always been a powerful business model, the changes ushered in by the networked age have made them potentially more valuable than ever. But unlike a local market with its size constraints, think of an old-fashioned bazaar in the center of a populous city, online marketplaces tap a global market, and by connecting buyers and sellers instead of holding inventory or managing logistics, and thus dealing in bits rather than atoms, online marketplaces avoid many of the growth limits of human or infrastructure scalability. Proven pattern number 5, subscriptions. When Salesforce.com first launched its on-demand customer relationship management product, there were many legitimate questions about this new software as a service, SaaS, or SaaS, model. Selling software as a subscription, delivered via the internet, represented a major departure for enterprise software vendors. The previous model of selling permanent licenses for on-premise software and charging for maintenance provided more cash up front than monthly or annual subscriptions. The personnel required to support the model were also different. Selling and supporting on-premise software required field salespeople and sales engineers to install pilot deployments, while the new SaaS model required additional staff to provide 24/7 data center coverage and support. As it turns out, of course, SaaS eventually became the dominant business model for enterprise software. The cash flow disadvantages and required personnel shifts were real concerns, but mainly for existing players in the market. New SaaS businesses like Salesforce.com and Workday were designed and built around the new model, giving them a major advantage over existing players who tried to convert their on-premise software businesses to subscription ones. Subscription internet services have been successful because the sales and delivery model provides a larger market size and better distribution than traditional packaged software. Due to the cost and overhead of the extensive field operations required to support on-premise software, traditional enterprise software licenses had to be in the 6- or 7-figure range simply to make the model work. This meant that software vendors focused on the needs of only the largest customers. In contrast, Salesforce.com and other SaaS vendors can sell software licenses in any quantity, not only to Fortune 500 companies, but also to mid-market and small to medium-sized businesses, significantly enlarging their potential market. Internet delivery and self-service allow new forms of distribution that weren't possible in the packaged software world, such as Dropbox's viral incentive of additional free storage for referring new customers. Nor is the pattern of internet subscriptions limited to enterprise software. The dominant players in both music, Spotify, Pandora, and video, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, also enjoy lower overhead and greater distribution by using the subscription business model. Another less obvious benefit to this model is that once a subscription business achieves scale, the predictability of its revenue streams allows it to be more aggressive with long-term investments, since it isn't obliged to maintain large cash balances to weather short-term variations in the business. This financial firepower can represent a major competitive advantage. For example, Netflix, which announced plans to invest $6 billion in original content for its streaming service in 2017, has exploited its direct subscription model to outspend classic television networks, which have to rely on less robust revenue streams like payments from cable providers and advertising sales. Proven pattern number 6, digital goods. One of the emerging patterns that build on new platforms and services is the business of selling digital goods. Sitting at the intersection of bits rather than atoms and platforms, digital goods are intangible products that arguably have no intrinsic value, but they can still make for a profitable and scalable business. For example, the messaging service Line derives significant revenues by selling stickers, images that are incorporated into the text of smartphone messages. In 2014, its first year of operation, Line's sticker business generated $75 million in revenue. That figure grew to $270 million in 2015, which represented over a quarter of Line's total revenues. Not bad for an intangible product with no intrinsic value. Digital goods have also become a key business model in the video game industry, with in-game purchases of digital items that can help players advance in the game or advertise their status. Market-wide revenue from in-app purchases are projected to outstrip paid app downloads in 2017, $37 billion to $29 billion. In addition to enjoying the advantages of any bits-based business, digital goods tend to have nearly 100% gross margins, since they are purely digital and usually do not add significantly to infrastructure or overhead costs. Proven pattern number 7, feeds. One of the most underrated and underappreciated proven patterns is the news feed. Facebook's powerful network effects allow the site to attract its users, but its innovation of the news feed has made it a world-class business. Yet Facebook is hardly the only feed-centric success story. Companies like Twitter, Instagram, and Slack have all built multi-billion dollar market values around the newsfeed pattern. The power of the newsfeed comes from its ability to drive user engagement, which in turn drives both advertising revenue and long-term retention. As Facebook has demonstrated, a newsfeed with sponsored updates is the most effective way to monetize proverbial internet eyeballs. Facebook's newsfeed's dominance of the online advertising market is only exceeded by Google's AdWords, and AdWords starts with a significant built-in advantage of capturing active consumer intent rather than simply the desire to be amused. For example, how many people visit Facebook with the intention of going shopping? The magic of the newsfeed model has been its ability to monetize bored people catching up on what their friends are doing. Of course, effective use of the newsfeed model requires a lot of sophisticated technology. Facebook doesn't just insert sponsored updates at random. The company knows your interests better than you do based on all the items you've ever clicked on, liked, or otherwise engaged with. It can carefully target the advertisements it shows you based on your individual habits and the context of what surrounds them in your feed. This targeting ability explains why Facebook succeeded in monetizing this model when other feed-based products like RSS readers failed. This pattern is so powerful that Twitter, whose product is essentially one long newsfeed, is still an important internet company despite barely changing its product in nearly a decade. Going from 140 characters to 280 characters doesn't count. Twitter is a business that scaled massively because of the power of business model innovation, not product or technology innovation. The underlying principles of business model innovation. Underlying the proven patterns of business model innovation are larger principles that can help refine those patterns or even create new ones. These principles aren't themselves business models, but they often power the technological innovation that enables business model innovation. Underlying principle number 1, Moore's Law. Moore's Law is the fundamental principle that puts the silicon in Silicon Valley and has powered the worldwide ascent of the technology industry. Moore's Law is named after its codifier, Intel co-founder Gordon Moore, who coined the term in a paper he wrote in 1965, observing that the number of transistors that could be crammed onto the surface of a silicon chip appeared to double every year. While Moore revised his eponymous law in 1975 to a doubling of transistors every 24 months, the industry has since settled on a broad consensus of 18 months. Today, Moore's law no longer refers specifically to transistor density. Rather, it predicts that computing power tends to double every 18 months. In recent years, this growth in computing power has been driven by the transition to multi-core, multi-threaded computing. Perhaps in the future, Moore's law will be met by quantum computing, optical chips, the use of DNA, or something even more impossible to foresee. The point is, it appears that the true limit to Moore's law is human engineering ingenuity, not solid-state physics. Moore's law matters because the relentless increase in computing power that it predicts acts as a constant source of technological innovation, which, as we have seen, can help enable business model innovation. For many years, the power of Intel's central processing units, CPUs, was measured by their clock rate, the number of times per second that the CPU could perform an operation. While clock rate is no longer a good measure of computing power, it is still a good metaphor for how Moore's law drives the world of computer technology. Each tick of the clock enables new technologies, driving faster and faster innovations. Increasing computer power allowed the shift from gigantic mainframes to smaller mini-computers to personal computers, all the way to today's smartphones and wearables. We've seen similar increases in things like network bandwidth, allowing the web to shift from text to images to audio to video, and in the future, 3D and virtual reality, VR. Yet today's smartphones aren't simply smaller versions of IBM mainframes. Remember, technology innovation enables business model innovation. The best entrepreneurs don't just follow Moore's law, they anticipate it. Consider Reed Hastings, the co-founder and CEO of Netflix. When he started Netflix, his long-term vision was to provide television on demand delivered via the internet. But back in 1997, the technology simply wasn't ready for his vision. Remember, this was during the era of dial-up internet access. 1 hour of high-definition video requires transmitting 40 gigabytes of compressed data, over 400 gigabytes without compression. A standard 28.8 modem from that era would have taken over 4 months to transmit a single episode of Stranger Things. However, there was a technological innovation that would allow Netflix to get partway to Hastings' ultimate vision, the DVD. Hastings realized that movie DVDs, then selling for around $20, were both compact and durable. This made them perfect for running a movie rental-by-mail business. Hastings has said that he got the idea from a computer science class in which one of the assignments was to calculate the bandwidth of a station wagon full of backup tapes driving across the country. This was truly a case of technological innovation enabling business model innovation. Blockbuster Video had built a successful business around buying VHS tapes for around $100 and renting them out from physical stores, but the bulky, expensive, fragile tapes would never have supported a rental-by-mail business. As hard as it may be for some listeners to comprehend, when we were in college, we would often drive to a Blockbuster Video store on a Friday or Saturday night, pay a couple of bucks to rent a VHS tape of a movie, and use a landline telephone to call Domino's to order a pizza, before popping the videotape into a VCR that was connected to a 25-inch standard-definition cathode ray tube. DVD technology allowed Netflix to create a completely new business model. Rather than renting out individual movies and being charged exorbitant late fees if they failed to return the VHS tape in time, Netflix customers paid $20 per month for a subscription to unlimited movies, provided they checked out just one movie at a time. This allowed Netflix to eliminate Blockbuster's widely loathed late fees and capture the powerful and certain revenue stream from the proven model of a subscription service. Netflix took off and even went public as a DVD by mail service. But Hastings never lost sight of his ultimate vision for Netflix, on-demand television delivered via the internet. And as Moore's law continued to work its magic, making computers ever more powerful and internet bandwidth ever greater and cheaper, Netflix bided its time, waiting for streaming video to become viable. When we first started raising money in 1997, we thought we'd be mostly streaming in 5 years, Hastings told us when he visited our blitz scaling class at Stanford. In 2002, we had no streaming, so we thought that by 2007, it would be half our business. In 2007, we were still nowhere, so we made the same prediction, and this time we were wrong the other way, By 2012, streaming was 60% of our business. It may have taken longer than Hastings expected, but Moore's Law eventually came through for him. Today, Netflix is synonymous